Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Marguerite Young's Angel in the Forest. Pouring myself some tea, but I don't think it... Well, let's steep some more. It's a garden party tea. Harney and Sons makes the best tea. And, It's pretty light though. Happy Letha, summer solstice to everyone who is celebrating it. I'm new to celebrating it, but it was. I think those were gunshots. I don't think it was fireworks. Dang it. It's been very quiet summer. 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, okay. Paradise was lost. We begin on one page 131. I'm pretty sure it's we'll finish in one episode. Sorry. My allergies have been wonderful. This year. I don't know why, but it's been great. But I've just got a little bit. Like, it's not enough to take allergy medicine. It's just annoying, but it's not enough to do anything about it. All right, paradise was lost. Indicative of the macrocosm was the microcosm, a reflection in the small of larger issues. Partner William Allen, although wearing a Quaker's gray, was fanatic in his conservatism. He had entered the partnership only reluctantly at the express word of God because of the strength I might have in opposing any infidel plans of R.O. Liberty he believed to be neither in doing what we please, as if we were waves tossed by every wind, nor in being governed by laws of human conception and authorship. For him the old order had its own peculiar virtue, which was the handwriting of God on every wall. He believed this world to be, by its very nature, adjusted to dissolve. It had been destroyed by water, and it would be destroyed by fire. This human life was not, from his point of view, the sty of Epicurus, a bedlam. Far from being merely sensual creatures, men were ever subject to the law of God, and free in proportion as they acknowledged it, enslaved in proportion as they ignored it. How foolhardy to build a village on any human frontier when one could march directly to the great capital, the center which was God's. The flight of the alone to the alone. It would be well to recognize that man could not live ethically in accordance with nature, at least at this date. Animal man, wherever he was, must be overwhelmed and conquered by ethical man, an angel with streaming hair, a flame of fire. By this means only could the brother of the wolf be converted to serve as guardian of the flock. A free monarchy, like England, seemed the nearest approximation yet to that state where the wolf guards the golden pasture. William Allen, far from rejecting the complicated machinery of civilization, considered that the division of society into governors and governed, rich and poor, learned and unlearned, single families, sex and classes, was God's plan, a good deal ahead of Robert Owen's. The simplest state, such as his junior partner had in mind, would be inevitably a state of tyranny. Without the power of traditions, customs, and rival interests, there would be, in fact, a despotism, inevitable as the worm in the wheat. The will of the Machiavellian prince would be the absolute law. Such prince is generally inclined toward exotic dreams. Wrapped in clouds of darkness, he transfers his power to a few smooth-cheeked agents, his eunuchs, who are as ruthless as he, but actively so, as they try to make real the delusional world their leader lives in. If murder is his dream, they kill for the abject pleasure of killing. In such a government, the sovereign is the heir of all his subjects. He seizes on their property, sometimes before their murder, sometimes after, as the impulse strikes him. He does not have to show even the thread of an excuse. There being no law but his own arrogant will, he may decide on any successor to the crown, good, bad, or indifferent, strong or feeble-minded. Dying, he is not dead. If there are, however, competitors for the crown, a civil war follows, and woe to the innocent bystander in the streets of that city. The victor removes his brothers and near relations by various means, imprisonment, decapitation, putting out their eyes, or making them swallow drugs which will deprive them of their senses so that they hiss like geese, so that they squeal like pigs. Nothing but fear could support such a state, or could endure the reduction of existence to the relation of an all-encompassing despot and thoughtless slave population suspended midway between life and death, like Mahomet's coffin, a thing said to be midway between heaven and earth. Far from abandoning the complicated machinery of English government, William Allen would die in the slough of despond to defend it. at least if he had not been a Quaker. The subtle refinements of civilized life should not be thrown overboard for the sake of a blank page in the books of nature, he thought. Fortunately, the spirit of God dwelled among the tombs of old faiths beyond the reaches of materialistic socialism forever was not to be destroyed. Robert Owen declared that he opened the book of nature. William Allen was most surprised at what his junior partner read there. Social organization for which Robert Owen would sacrifice the institutions of the past was nothing worth striving for, William Allen believed. Even wolves hunt in packs and hornets are gregarious. As for the universe, of which his junior partner talked so much, it was a thing devoid of meaning except for God's word. The fact of God himself showed the universe to be unreasonable. Man alone and lonely must be ever on guard against cosmic processes, whose ends were not his ends, as might be gathered by anyone who had ever observed a dead sparrow falling. The wicked prosper, as Jesus Christ remarked, and the good die young, and the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children. Thousands must pay for the crime of one who may be only their human nature aggrandized and made explicit in unholy of unholies. Our only salvation, from William Allen's point of view, was to withdraw from the arena of conflict and to place our souls like sparrows in the hands of God. If then falling, they do not fall. A better book by far than nature, a crudity, was the Bible, wherein was written all that was necessary for a man to know. The moral law, the taxation system among the Levites, the amount of the widow's tithes, the measurements employed by the glorious architect Solomon, the multiplication of Jacob's spotted kine. Other than these clarities, there was, there would be, an eternal mystery. Our globe might be, as some thought, on the upward road to heaven, but when it reached the crest of the hill and started to go down to hell, the stars following like a royal funeral cortege, what rationalist could stop it? He might bark at the stars, but what good? Far from supposing our intellect supernatural, a power to extend beyond the stars, men must pray simply for Gabriel's descent to the green hills of England, an unmechanized being with beard of gold like barley, who would bring with him the one secret of happiness not posited on 9/10 vanity and illusion. William Allen believed that, this side of paradise, there must be all kinds of differences in warring nature, the dove, the serpent, the wheat, the worm, chaos. It was not for nothing that he had visited in secluded Asiatic villages, untouched by progress or industry, where the farmers, poor mystics, had treated all worms as if they were in their place. What was the result but a paradise of worms? For nature was ever the negation of human values. It would be the same should the rich man treat all paupers as if he were in their place. Besides, who would consider riches the key of happiness? William Allen aspired after a bliss higher than this earth affords. In a sense, he was poverty-stricken, like leprous Mordecai, who sat with ashes of coal on his head and was unimpressed by the dazzle of any earthly prince, even the proud vizier of Ahasuerus, wearing a crown of diamonds. For had not God promised more and brighter diamonds than these, the poor result of coal? This present earth was an empty carriage, a parade of mummers, as compared with the New Jerusalem, where seraphim and cherubim, with their wings outspread, would not hide longer from the face of dusty man. For while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, and why prolong the period of our absence? What a joy it would be to come home again like the prodigal son for whom the fatted calf would be killed. The Lord would sweep on that day the first grain from the first threshing floor. Man should then eat of the prime bread, a sweetness as of dew. This expectation was William Allen's only goal in life. Sorry, my throat's feeling kind of rough. His junior partner's attitude toward happiness as physical enjoyment only, his rearing of infants as happy animals, less interested in their souls than the abdominal viscera, his attempt to release man from the fear of death or hope of heaven, these seemed to William Allen the work of the devil himself. Paradise was forfeited long before the cotton trade arose. There had been a silk manufacturer, an evil pharaoh, the slaughter of the firstborn, dreamer of dreams, long before the rise of industrial England was so much as thought of. All social changes must take place slowly, over a period of centuries, for fear they should throw the baby out with the bath. Had not God moved but slowly since the seventh day when he rested? William Allen was a mystic and a gentleman of the old school. In another environment, preferably Asiatic, he might have covered his head with ashes and fed his heart to ravens. Instead, he went to dinner parties and would not ask for a second helping of roast beef. He had taken a vow that until the slave trade was abolished, with God's help, he would not use sugar in his tea. God helped him for 43 years. There was a precarious moment when the divinity hung in the balance, the Emperor of Russia having offered him a cup of tea with sugar in it. The spirit triumphing over the flesh, William Allen called for plain tea with profuse apologies. He thanked God that at another dinner party in Moscow he was able to hand in a Russian princess. He was able to hand in a Russian princess of the blood without tragic embarrassment, such as might be caused by an ill-timed cough or stubbing his toe. He was always embarrassed. His spirit was caught between two advancing armies. Although he was peace-loving and would not have stepped on a fly, he knew his littleness. Being a self-made man, he would have liked to kick the ladder out from under him to deny his relation with lions, tigers, and yawning cosmic forces. He knew the impossibility of this. He prayed God to accompany him from room to room and point out the least conspicuous chair. Thus he had kept, with God's help, to the plain road of truth. Though according to his junior partner's assumption, he was launched into the wilds of the imagination, was lost in a maze of obscurity. Rather, Robert Owen, a chaser after that will-o'-the-wisp, the science of society, was a lost soul. Perhaps the past history of mankind, as Robert Owen said, ought to be scratched out. Only God, however, could efface the writing on that page of nature. For this world, its human institutions, its furniture, even its nests of foxes, were God's signature on space. It is a mystery of God to conceal a matter, but it is the nature of kings to search it out. Pain and sorrow knocked at William Allen's doors more loudly than happiness. His diary records his constant searchings after the truth, his communion with one who sitteth on a high throne. How could an honest man dangle an illusion of perfection as a bait before the eyes of that poor mute fish, humanity? William Allen insisted that reading be introduced into the New Lanark schools, as from the sacred word alone the children might learn who their true maker was. They must understand that the split in the universe had not been caused by the split between Tories and Whigs, but that there had been a quarrel among good and evil angels long ago. Man was but a poor dog tied to a post and barking at shadows, as all around him circled the transient union of flesh with spirit. Till flesh dropped away, there would be no harmony, no happiness. The children must understand their relation to a higher nature, or otherwise they should never be transported to a better world than this. Apart from God, there was no reality. Apart from God, human personality was the great lie, whether adhering to Pericles or the slave he threw to the dogs. The true religion was only this, therefore, to realize, as an inward light, though not the light of reason, man's nothingness, and that a poisonous dew can destroy him quite as effectively as the collapse of giant stars. No great catastrophe necessary. Did not an eagle drop a serpent on a king's head in a garden enclosed and protected? For there was always the sky's immensity. The children must walk with utter humility and eyes downcast, yet with the tales of Miss Maria Edgeworth and the shorter catechism, be able to withstand the awful powers, the infidel and infidelity, the aggregate of Democritean atoms, the concept of a universe devoid of angels, sporting in fields of asphodel somewhere in future time? Surely God, the supreme will, was ever the cause of sensation, and would pluck out the eyes of the offender. Surely God, not Robert Owen, was everywhere. William Allen was staggered by the thought of his junior partner's inflated ego. Robert Owen would rue the day he set out to reform the world. God himself had not promised so much. Robert Owen was a helmsman without a helm to steer by, a vessel lost in the wide gulf. A single nuisance, yet multiple as the sands of the sea, and never to evolve in time or space, one perfect pearl, which is faith in the Almighty God. Had not God, speaking out of the whirlwind, taunted Job with his ignorance, that he had not seen the copulation of elephants and knew not the composition of hail? Robert Owen was less wise than Job, certainly, a poor optimist, as if nature itself did not preclude the fact of happiness, nature being the mistaken mother. Oh, yeah. I thought I hadn't let the tea steep enough, but yeah, it's just a light color tea. William Allen's apostolic mother refused to stay in the same room with Robert Owen, as he contaminated the furniture with his philosophy, she complained. Singing and dancing, moreover, were in direct opposition to William Allen's faith in his Creator, who had a sad, unhappy face, as he had witnessed from his high vantage ground the crystallization of Lot's wife, a plot against Wellington, and numerous other disasters. The bare legs of the mill children in their Greek tunics suggested a training for immorality in brothel houses. Military drill might well cultivate in the children a taste for the moribund pleasures of war, such as that of Hyder Ali, who erected for his delight a pyramid of human skulls. Every Tamerlane must have his army, his prisoners caged like featherless birds. The intention of so many distinguished visitors would make the mill children conscious of their importance, spoiled, unwilling to adjust to the harsh demands of adult life, when they should be no longer cherished by a mad millionaire who simply preferred these pets to peacocks. The adjunct of his vanity. If so happy now, how would they be happy as saddlers, tillers of the soil, workers in wood and bronze, blacksmiths, butchers? How would the dancers ever turn to face reality when their hands should be blistered at the plow? Or should every farmer wear a golden crown like that of George III? That would be a state of luxury indeed, but doubtless would comprise no more happiness than present disorders, since even a king is made to plow the infinite, yea, yearn for heaven above. William Allen carried credentials from above, stamped with the authentic seal of an ever-active God, whose reign falls alike on the rich and the poor. He came to New Lanark as minister of justice, ambassador of the deity, spokesman for a higher law than nature's, etc. He carried no golden book or sickle, but was simplicity itself, fawning under a black umbrella, a long, light, loose gentleman. In the Owen household, it is true, he found no skeleton, everybody most kind. He could not help admiring the lady, whose devotion to a higher power was evident throughout Baxfield Manor. There was even her open Bible on the drawing-room table, its pages marked with a crimson oak leaf, a stain of autumn upon the holy pristine words, as if God were aware of her precarious situation. Yet there was something sinister in the whole atmosphere, a feeling of lingering decay, a feeling that there ought to be a murderous lord on these premises, or at least a skeleton playing a harp hung among barren trees. Surely this materialistic socialism would cut away all faith of man in his creator if it had its way. William Allen told the wide-eyed Owen children that they could come to find God in the community of angels no fiction, as they now believed, but the most potent, the most fruitful truth. It was only God who could heal the Owen children through the wilderness. William Allen said God who could decoy the birds of heaven in one net, God who could open closed doors, God who could restore a lost manhood, revive Lazarus. God was not the product of a diseased imagination as Hamlet was, but the one true story, beginning, middle, and end. All works of fiction ought to be burned simultaneously throughout the civilized world in huge bonfires, and Shakespeare's sonnets as well, though William Allen had rather enjoyed them, the crying of a soul in distress. But how much better if Shakespeare had cried out after not a dark lady but God? William Allen felt that the needs of the body were few as compared with the needs of the soul, and that the absolute was absolute, as Jacob's ladder, a rock of ages, a golden rose, and in Jerusalem, a crown of crowns. He interviewed with painstaking care the workers of New Lanark cotton mills. He went around in good weather with his umbrella under his arm, always expecting a deluge to overwhelm him and cast him, like Jonah, into the mouth of the whale. He was Daniel indeed in the lion's den, helpless as the infant Moses in a cradle of bulrushes. God's most humble servant, the child of David, the child of Judah, the worker still believed in God, he found, and the extremes of moral destiny, and would not give a straw for the things of this world. Yea, they said, a rich man should no more enter the kingdom of heaven than a fly. Not a few had witnessed wonderful deathbed scenes when the corrupt body had seemed phosphorescent as a fish. They had heard, in fact, the rustle of Gabriel's skirts like a surf on a lonely shore when blind Jamie breathed his last. It was beautiful. Many men intended to wear thick-soled shoes in his coffin in case he should walk the roads of burning hell. Many women planned to hold in her hand a small keepsake, such as a baby's curl. There was an ancient dame, who thanked God for the mole on her face, for by it she would remember earth when she became an angel and every homely item, even the chicken scratching in the dooryard and the smell of hot kidney. Some were keeping their hair combings in chimney corners so that they would have all their hair in heaven. Others saved their old ruined teeth. The familiar views persisted. Indeed, Robert Owen had never tried to undermine their faith in a higher power, the workers reported, and that his views had not made the slightest mark on man or stone. In spite of this failure, he was a very good man and excellent employer. He even paid as good as a cockfight repeated on mirrors of the infinite. Everybody was happy, apparently, as Robert Owen was the loser. William James came away from his visit in a most in an almost cheerful state of mind, happy that New Lanark had not deteriorated under the effects of John Locke's view that the mind is born a blank page where any writing can be traced. I now feel very peaceful, he wrote in his diary, yet rumors year after year besiege his fortress in the City of God. If he so much as stepped his foot out of the door, he heard of that man's doings at New Lanark, his public speeches in London. People were beginning to identify him with his junior partners, that on two or three occasions he had suffered an intense social mortification as if it were he who fostered bare-legged dancing. In 1822, William Allen wrote his final letter to the skeptic, deist, pantheist, positivist, sentimentalist, cold-blooded machine, blind fool, harmonist, atomist, dictator, communist, worm, terrestrial, Elijahist, Don Quixote of the cotton mills, etc. He appreciated Robert Owen's benevolent intentions, but was sorry to say he felt their principles to be diametrically opposed, like the road to heaven, the road to hell. He was grieved by Robert Owen's lack of faith in a superior being, who had handed down of old a complete set of values, and who had hidden a Bible in the widow's dough at New Lanark. He wished his correspondent, in spite of their intrinsic differences, the best of health, personally, and may that great and holy being who seeth not as man sees so influence thy heart before the shades of evening close upon thee, that it may become softened and receive those impressions which he alone can give, and then thou wilt perceive that there is indeed something infinitely beyond human reason. At present, however, it is quite plain that we must part. God, not human reason, had been a pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. God, not human reason, had multiplied the loaves. He reminded his correspondent, first, of these forgotten truths, and second, of his failure to carry out the least command of a financial superior at New Lanark. He had waited patiently for a change of circumstance. He had desired that all males from the age of 6 upwards wear trousers or drawers. Drawers is kind of underwear or shorts. His agents informed him that the children were still dancing in their nightshirts to the tune of a Scottish flute, a heathen instrument. He had desired that the children give up the study of moral geography. His agents informed him that the children were still examining the economy of nations which practice infanticide, prostration before wooden gods, etc., that according to the religions of such peoples, the children were taught the soul of man may be secreted even during his lifetime in a gourd or the hairs of his head. Children, through such comparisons, come to an awful doubt, the feeling that there is no everlasting truth, no rock of ages, but only error. William Allen believed. He had not objected to the study of anatomy, but had despised in his heart some of the deductions drawn from it. He would have permitted an examination of human skulls, but only on condition that the conclusions drawn as to man's nature was God's conclusions. John Walker, another of Robert Owen's Quaker partners, sympathized with the great work going on at New Lanark. He would have been an active supporter had it not been for his sense of the unreality of all things, including himself. He was not sure that God upheld the continuity of moments or made a difference between sweet and sour. There were blank spaces, and at such time, almost anything might happen. Excuse me. John Walker pitied himself with his whole heart, for he was a martyr to luxury, as he said, having been born with a gold spoon in his mouth, a crown of vipers on his head, a pair of crutches in his hands, the great cross of great wealth upon his back, a dim eyesight, an overactive sense of hearing, a skin like a drum, a dry palate, an unreliable apparatus for smelling. His hardship was that he had everything, wife, children, palaces, swans, servants, horses, saintly aunts, a pet zebra, and marble statues, which had been fished up by fishermen in the Aegean Sea, and nothing. Absolutely nothing could give him happiness. Due to his unfortunate sensory equipment, he was like an Aeolian harp, played upon by every nervous wind. He had once heard, while shut up in his closet, the clanging of buoys in a distant harbor. When an old peasant woman 3 miles down the road was dying, he had heard the rasping of her breath like wind at the shutter, so that in an atmosphere of utmost privacy, he could find no privacy whatever. He had been known to faint upon smelling a rose, as if poison had been distilled throughout his system. If he so much as looked at a haystack, his eyes were fountains. He suffered from blind headaches and felt, indeed, like an atlas, with the entirety of earth on his head. His sympathies were so diffused, so unorganized, he could hardly put one foot in front of another. When he thought of the cotton children, then at that moment there would obtrude upon him as equally sad the lamentations of wild goats at their communal burial place, so that he was utterly helpless even to lift a hand. What was the enormity of his own personality that he himself should become a majority? Wild goats, cotton children, woodpeckers, the base of the pyramid. He felt that he had not been naturally endowed with a sense of reason, order, and correct standards. His nearest approach to happiness was his feeling of deprivation, that he was not limited to the things near at hand, but was amorphous, and being everywhere was in no particular place, as if he were himself the very idea of all mankind. During a prolonged visit to Rome, searching for mystic certitude, he had almost become a convert to the Catholic order, almost overwhelmed by incense and ritual. He had felt like swooning in the paltry Vatican among blue-veined marble Madonnas, cousins German to the poor remnants fished up from the Aegean Sea. As at times, though aware of a pig squealing on its way to slaughter, perhaps in England, he had felt an influence of heavenly beams lighting up what part of his mind was not absent, and had seen a cosmos evolving with mighty grandeur out of the human psychological chaos, and a figure encompassed by stars like golden pomegranates. He had heard, while the pig squealed under the butcher's knife, a swan singing for the last of earth most melodiously. Oh, how he had yearned to throw himself at the feet of the Pope, who seemed the center of harmony, so far distant from pig squealing. Oh, how he had yearned to be a short-haired priest then, not merely a poor, sensual Quaker. But as he was already attached to his wife, good lady, and her children, there was no escape from skepticism and disorder. He had remained as the priest of his own soul, caught like a fly in the spider's web of his own weaving. As a result of many confusions, John Walker believed that the highest good should be a ceiling placed upon desire, a limitation. Man should be taught little more than necessary for his body's perpetuation. Could John Walker have made his choice again, could he have lived his life over, he would have been a farmer in a turnip field. In such a life, had it been his misfortune to beget children, he would have raised them as ironmongers, blacksmiths, butchers, candlestick makers. That state would have been at least less puzzling than this, he believed. Alrighty, that's the end of that chapter. And thank you for listening. Bye.